there is another type of startup, and we call them foundational startups. So foundational startups are startups that are creating basic foundational bricks that can be used by everyone.
Mm.
So OpenAI, of course, comes to mind, but you have others. So for example, Figures is creating humanoid all-purpose robots. So basically, you don't have to train anything and the robot is moving. And so, for example, in a warehouse, you can put those robots and they start working alone. So that's the second. We call them foundational startups.
Yeah.
And they basically, their idea and what they want to do is to take 5% of everybody's revenue.
Yeah, right.
Welcome to Innovation Talks. Join us weekly as we discuss with distinguished industry guests how to refine and improve corporate innovation and new product development. Hosted by Paul Heller, Sophion Chief Evangelist.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. I hope you're having a great week out there and things are going well for you. You know, we've talked about innovation. We've talked about manufacturing. Today, we have a chance to kind of bring these things together a little bit. My guest today is Ronan Devier, and he's the CEO of a company that's really focused on making a positive impact on society and change. He's had some background working for the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. He's worked in Brazil. He's worked in the U.S. And now he's founded something that we'll talk about called OSS Ventures, which is a firm focused on creating startups from manufacturing. So that's really interesting. Ronan, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And where are you talking to us from today?
So I'm based in Paris, France.
Uh-huh. Sounds wonderful. Yeah. And is it spring there yet?
It's rainy time, so
yeah.
Don't over-romantize the thing.
Yeah. Well, summer's coming. Now, Ronan, just tell us a little bit about your background and you know, how you kind of got into the manufacturing side of things and how you eventually founded OSS Ventures.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up a little all over the world because my dad was in the military, and I was good at math. And as I was good at math, there is that weird thing in France where you get paid to do the studies of mathematics. And so I was very happy getting paid in one of the best schools in math in France, specialized in computing, specialized in software engineering, electrical engineering. And 2 months before the end of my studies, I learned that I had two choices, either paying back everything that I had gained for 2 years, which was not an option, or become a public servant.
Ah.
And so I went to Google and I put highest paid public servant France in Google. And the answer was OECD, because you are an international public servant and so you don't pay taxes. So I went to the OECD for 2 years and one day, to pay back my studies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a lot of things, but I started become interested in manufacturing and operations and the world of physical things. And over the course of 8 years, I worked in operations. So I was a consultant. I was a factory director. I was a supply chain specialist. I ended up being in the COO office of the Richemont Group, which is one of the largest luxury group in the world, because in Europe, luxury is big, right? So I worked on that. It was very interesting and all the jazz. But there was a but, which is that I'm a nerd. I always was a nerd, a geek. I love that kind of things. And so on the day I was with a tie in a factory pretending to not know about technology, and in night and weekends, I created the first hackerspace in Switzerland. And so at some point I said, okay, I want to work in tech. I want to use my passion to do something. So I created a tech company focused on AI for recruitment of blue collar jobs. I did every single mistake you can do as a first-time founder, but at the end it worked. We went from 0 to 80 employees. We went to Brazil because of a data privacy law in Europe, so we had to go to Brazil. So we went to Brazil. We were doing a lot of recruitments over there, raised some funds in Silicon Valley. I discovered Silicon Valley and ended up selling my shares at the Series B of the company. And so here I was, 29-year-old, with way more money that I could imagine, and bored out of my mind. And I did a lot of things to just find what was next. Mm. And one thing that I did is I visited Tesla Fremont in California. I had been to like hundreds of factories in my career.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the only factory of this type that I was seeing. And I thought to myself, okay, this is the future. I'm literally living in the future right now.
Wow.
And my thesis is very simple, is that the way that Tesla handles physical production is to physical production what Toyota was to physical production 20 years ago.
Okay.
And so the question is, if you had been someone with some money and you went to the first Toyota factory, they invented lean, they invented the new way of organizing factories.
Yeah.
What should you do? Like, what should you do? And so my answer was creating OSS Ventures. And OSS Venture creates and or invests in startups that bring the world of technology to the world of operations.
Mm-hmm.
We've been doing that for 4 years. We created 15 companies. There are around 500 people working in all that. And we deployed 1,700 factories all over the world in 4 years. So it's good news because I primarily created that with my money, which was an interesting conversation with my wife. And so, yeah, we are trying to bring tech to the world of manufacturing and operations. That was
yeah. What an experience. What a setup. You've already seen in your life a tremendous amount of things, and to kind of see the different factory that Tesla had and how it was different. That's really interesting. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you saw it different? What was different about it?
So there are two ways of looking at it. One is purely from a numbers perspective, and the other is from a feeling/experience perspective. From a numbers perspective, when you buy $100 worth of a Tesla product, you are buying $14 of software.
Okay.
When you are buying $100 of a Ford product, you are buying $4 of software.
Okay.
So the amount of software in the physical product is massive, and roughly half of it is in the product and half of it is in the factory.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way of looking at it. Like the amount of software that is used in the physical product and processes is just times three. That's the very number left brain way of looking at it. The right brain way of looking at it is it's answering the question, what if a tech founder was in charge of a factory?
Yeah.
What would that look like? Well, the answer is a Tesla factory. So, for example, most factories are built like CPUs to optimize for flows.
Yeah.
Rather than your typical lean organization with one flow going one direction, in a CPU, it's more radial optimization. So the flows are around the center. Mm-hmm. Another thing is to see that there are coders actively coding the machines right next to the machines, which is something that you don't see in regular factories. The amount of software and how deep it goes in the product. So for example, when you brake with a Tesla car, it's 75% software and 25% hardware. When you brake with a Ford or a Stellantis, Peugeot or whatever, it's 75% hardware. And so that thinking, which comes from Apple and considering the hardware as the platform for software, really, and that you innovate and you have shorter innovation cycle on the software and you put that on top of hardware and at the end you win. That way of thinking of the product and the processes is very, very different. Yeah. It's a very different organization.
That's fascinating. You know, that we think about if you're pure software company and you're making the software, there's really no manufacturing, right? You just put your software out there. When you're a pure product company, manufacturing is everything. It's a major investment. Even when you come up with a new product, you've got to manufacture it. But this hybrid mode, I heard two things. One is I heard just the amount of software that's in this case in the vehicle. But the second is the amount of software that's in the manufacturing facility, the line itself.
Yeah. So let me take an example. Everybody in the automotive world is speaking about gigacasting. So gigacasting is basically the fact that you can create the hull of a car in one go. Okay. Rather than doing it in like 30 different pieces and having some guy like smoldering it together.
Yes, right. The traditional model.
What happens for 90% of the cars in the world. Yeah. So for gigacasting, the bottleneck to creating a gigapress is not hardware. The hardware is hardware from 20 years ago. What is the bottleneck is 400 sensors. And a real-time AI that will do the casting differently based on what the sensors are saying that the reaction is going on. And this in less than like 50 milliseconds.
Yeah.
And so that is the bottleneck. The bottleneck is software and AI to create a new kind of process that just breaks the economical equation of the casting of a new hull of a car. And what is true for automotive, for example, one of our biggest partner, industrial partners. The name is Coty. It's a L'Oreal competitor. So they do perfumes and things like that. They were thinking of maybe putting factories in different geographies.
Yeah.
And the reason why is that everybody wants hyper personalization. And so you get, you cannot have one product do 1 million units anymore. Yeah. You have one product doing 500 units, 1,000 units. And when you have that, the real question is how economical is it to do it? And so you have someone to code the machines. You have someone to code things. You have someone who creates the prints and everything. And so they were thinking, okay, this is getting uneconomical because one unit has less and less batch size and everything. And so they completely flipped because now an AI is programming the machine, an AI is doing the printing, and so there's no human involved. And so if you want, you could create a perfume and have like 5 units sold.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Tremendous economy of scale. Just ability to go at that level was unheard of even as much as 10 years ago, right? Yeah. The 1,700 factories. That's a lot of factories.
That's a lot of factories.
What type of factories? What type of products? Where are they in the world?
So it's 40% France because we started in France, but it's 40% Europe and it's 20% in the US. Mm-hmm. And the US is the fastest growing geography of all the factories that we are deploying. And we are in every single type of factories.
Okay.
So we are in aerospace, luxury, defense, food. We are in automotive. Obviously, we are in consumer goods. We are in ships. We are in mines. We are in oil and gas platforms. We are everything. Like one thing that I often say to potential founders who want to partner with us and everyone is that look all around you. Everything has been built in a factory.
Like, yeah.
Producing physical things is massive. It's 25% of the GDP. It's 40% of all the workers in the world. And so it's a massive industry and it used to be 0.7% of VC money. So very low innovation.
Yes. Yes.
It's almost doubling now in 24 compared to 21. So it's a good thing. And the last thing that I say to prospective founders is a very simple thing. If you look at the richest people in the world, Bernard Arnault, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos.
Yeah.
Very physical businesses, if you ask me.
Yeah. True. Isn't that true? Yeah. Yeah. I never thought about it that way. Yep. Yep. And so, you know, we often talk when we talk about innovation in manufacturing and it's how fast it's moving, the great opportunities. But I often talk about innovation on products and we talk about open innovation. And what we mean by that is innovation with startups, trying to find the right startups to help you innovate around a product. Tell us about how startups are kind of shaping the future of manufacturing.
So I think in manufacturing, there are four very distinct types of startups. The first type is what I call head-on competition. So head-on competition are startups that are coming for your business model.
Yeah, okay. Look so out.
If you're Airbus or Boeing, you're seeing SpaceX and saying to yourself, oh, snap.
That's
the first type. Actually, I think this type is very, very important for the ecosystem also because it forces big companies to innovate. When I was in the US, I was seeing Walmart and Amazon was on the rise, and Walmart started innovating for real because Amazon was there. Mm. Before, innovation was a theater show with people without budgets, nor power, nor vision. So they were not innovating. But when Amazon came for their lunch, they started innovating. And now the big winner is the consumer, because the consumer gets better quality and gets better served. So that's the first type of startup. There is another type of startup, and we call them foundational startups. So foundational startups are startups that are creating basic foundational bricks that can be used by everyone. Mm. So OpenAI, of course, comes to mind, but you have others. So for example, Figures is creating humanoid all-purpose robots. So basically, you don't have to train anything and the robot is moving. And so, for example, in a warehouse, you can put those robots and they start working alone. So that's the second. We call them foundational startups. Yeah. And their idea and what they want to do is to take 5% of everybody's revenue.
Yeah. Right.
So the way Amazon Web Services was to the web, there are probably robotics company that are going to be the Amazon Web Services for physical things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those are the second type. The third type are what we call service two. So service two are software and or hardware company that help you get into the business model, that help you do something that you couldn't do before. Sure. And so a lot of the OSS portfolio falls into that category. So mm-hmm. You want to put AI on top of any robot. How do you do? You take a platform and you use it. So that's the third type of startups. And the fourth type of startups are what we call distribution startups. Okay. And so distribution startups, they are basically innovating in how you distribute, how you get to the world, how you get with your supplier. Like, it's more of an ecosystem play and you organize the ecosystem. And so in our internal like way of looking at startups, we look for those four. Those are very, very different risk profiles. Of course, service to startups are the least risked mm-hmm. of that bunch, but foundational startups are IPO decacon material. So it's exciting.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we are looking at that. And the cool thing is that if you look at manufacturing like 5 to 10 years ago, it was missing the foundational startups. It was missing the head-on competition startups. And so the pace of innovation was very low. And so now that you have all four types of startups, innovation has to be high, because now it's the CEO job to not get behind. And it takes all four types of startups for a CEO to get bothered with that. Okay. For example, I was speaking with a very, very well-known software editor for manufacturing, like a very big one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he told me 5 years ago, I was seeing nobody that was good enough to disrupt me. And now I see another one every month. And
wow.
So that's the kind of environment and ecosystem that really drives innovation forward.
Yeah. I mean, I think of not too long ago, the whole industry 4.0 movement and who the leaders were. We don't need to mention names, but probably I can almost guess who you were talking to. But, you know, there were some big players there, and these concepts that you just mentioned, nobody was talking about them. So yeah, in just a few short years, significant change. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I have some numbers for you regarding industry 4.0. First, Industry 4.0 was mentioned 11 years ago in a German research paper. And the German Chamber of Commerce said, okay, we are going to sell more machines with that. Mm-hmm. And so they pushed the term and they pushed everything. And when you look at it 10 years later, over half of the projects were failures, and the overall return on investment is 1.2. So very, very low, like not interesting after 10 years. And you look at that and you say, okay, the value creation was slim. And then you look at Tesla, SpaceX and BYD and you say, okay, that is the future. And they don't speak about Industry 4.0. No. They don't speak about none of that thing.
Yeah.
They speak about business and they put tech in the business and it works. So
yeah. That's so true. So true. Just do it. Just get on and do it instead of being focused on the platform, the term. Yeah. Yeah. And these, you know, I think of the head on competition, you know, I always thought to make a manufacturing facility is a big investment. Is that changing now?
So it's really depends on the verticals. So, for example, now, if you want to set up a shop in aeronautics, the CapEx total investment is halved.
Okay.
So it's two times less expensive.
Yeah.
The reason for that is new machines, AI. You don't have to have like 20 years of experience anymore and things like that. If you look at food business, it's terribly expensive because there is a lot of regulation. If you look at pharma, there is still a lot of regulation. So verticals are being opened one by one, and there are somewhere there is less competition. For example, one that is extremely competitive right now is space. So new space in manufacturing. It used to be that launching your first satellite and doing the research and development, it was 100 million. It's 10 million now. It's probably going to be 2 million in 5 to 10 years because the cost of launch has been dramatically decreased. And so the good question becomes, when launches are this cheap, what are the new business model and what can you do with space?
Yeah.
And so a lot of verticals are opening like that. For example, there are a lot of startups, foundational startups, working on AI for complex machining. When you have AI for complex machining, you probably can lower the cost of any manufactured part by a factor of 10.
Yeah,
and so the good question becomes, when this is true, what becomes true? And so what is very, very interesting is that when you look at the startup, like the regular, like what people mean when they say tech world.
Yeah.
One big driving force was the cloud. Like when I was young, it was 20 years ago, unfortunately, when I was young, I created my first business. I had to create a server. I had to put it online. I had to put it in my dorm room at the time. It cost me the equivalent of 2 months' salary. And now a kid with $7 can create a server in 5 minutes.
Yeah, and in the cloud. Yeah, boom, done. Yeah. Yeah, a big server.
The same thing is happening for manufacturing.
Okay.
For example, when you look at CRISPR, CRISPR is a way of cutting DNA and recomposing it. With CRISPR, the cost for creating new drugs has been not divided by a factor of 10, but more by a factor of 100. Wow. And so what is the new world and the new businesses model when those foundational startups make it so that a new universe of possible come?
Yeah. You know, in preparing for this, I came across a term I didn't know, but it was called factory SaaS, or, you know, the SaaS. In fact, tell me about kind of where that. Is that a new term? Is that a term that you invented? Where did that come from?
Yeah, there's a joke that I learned from my time in San Francisco, which is that there are only two ways of making money in enterprise software. And it's either bundling or unbundling, but you have to be careful. And so I'll give you some numbers. You go to a typical factory today. The IT budget would be roughly 2% of sales, and 80% of that will be the ERP, which is typically 9 years old as an implementation, but 25 years old is the average age of the line of code.
Yeah.
The factory SaaS is saying two things. One, the total budget will go up and the ERP share in it will go down. Two, factory workers deserve good SaaS the way that developers deserve good SaaS. Like, if you go to a factory, so fun fact, there are more hardware coders than software coders in the world. They have none of the modern coding stack. So they have no GitHub. They have no code editor. They have no Copilot. Their code isn't checked real time against error. They have deployment time. They cannot work as a team, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Factory SaaS is just saying, okay, there are more hardware coders in the world than software coders. What do we do for these people? And is this going to be in the ERP? I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very disruptive, I think, for the ERP providers. It's a very disruptive innovation for sure. As it was for the PLM providers. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I was speaking with one of the big ERP providers and he was saying, so he was a strategy director. And one very interesting thing that he said to me is that Salesforce is now a bigger software editor than the biggest ERP software editor in the world.
Yeah.
40% of the growth of Salesforce can be attributed to the Salesforce ecosystem with apps on top of Salesforce. More than 10 companies are billion-dollar companies and there are apps on top of Salesforce. Yeah. ERP have none of that.
Yeah, it's true. So true.
Yeah. And so if I had to make a prediction, which is kind of a prediction I'm making because I'm heavily invested in that thesis, it's that we are going to see billion-dollar companies created as add-on to ERPs or like contingent to ERPs. And fun fact, ERPs have been invented in manufacturing to manage the supply chain of a woodworker 100 years ago, something like that.
Is that right? Yeah. Yes. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I have to look that up. Yeah. Yeah. When you think about these foundational startups that we were talking about, and I guess yet there's no major, like this is, I mean, like Amazon all of a sudden over some period of time became huge. I mean, that was it. It was just, and there were just a select few giants. I do you think it'll go the same way with the foundational startups? Do you think some of them will rise and it'll be, you know, one or two or a few that have it?
When you look at the foundational startups for software, there are like 20 of them.
Mm-hmm.
NVIDIA is a foundational startup for AI.
Yeah.
Took 25 years, I think.
Yeah.
I think foundational startups and companies by nature are very few. They need a lot of capital. Yeah. It's winner takes all or at least oligopolistic. When you look at the cloud, there are three relevant players, four if you count Alibaba, but it's a state actor. I think a limited number of foundational startups are going to be like that. There is one foundational startup already live, which is called SpaceX. SpaceX is going to be 5 to 10% of the space.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
There are going to be other, for example, with self-driving, very probably there are going to be car makers that are in reality the AWS of transportation and people are going to put business model on top of that.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
they are going to provide a commodity, like the base layer foundational of transportation. And so in terms of making new stuff, there are going to be foundational startups. So for example, I'm following closely a startup that is called Varda Space. And Varda Space is putting satellites in orbit and doing manufacturing operations that you couldn't make on Earth because of gravity.
Ah,
and so for example, space, like pharma is the first obvious use case where you make the first part of the use case because there's no gravity. You can make certain molecules that you couldn't make on Earth. And so there are probably going to be a tax on the GDP of the things that can be made in that situation. And so, yeah, foundational startups are very, very, it's exhilarating and risky and intellectual.
Thought-provoking. Yeah. Well, you look at NVIDIA, you mentioned them. I don't think anybody thought that they were going to, you know, become what they become around AI, but they were there. They were there, the right place, the right time, and boom. And that's the fun thing, I think, probably about these foundational startups is you just never know.
Yeah. And we talk a lot about foundational startups, but there are foundational companies right now. For example, there are like 6 big mining companies in the world. Mm-hmm. There are less than 10 oil companies in the world. Very probably those are going to be switched in the next 10 to 20 years. Mm. And so the multi-billion dollar question is what's going to replace them?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, it's interesting to think about.
It is. It is. Well, if you think about these four different types of startups, you know, what type of challenges are these startups having?
So our portfolio is heavily skewed toward service four, but we have a couple of foundational companies. We don't really have head-on competition in our portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would say is that for foundational, as it's winner takes all, you need to have access to the best talent pool. There are enormous technical bets, and it's a race against time and capital access. And it's very interesting. So those are foundational. For service two, which are startups that I also love, it's a lower risk selling. It's about building the right product for the right audience, having the right go-to-market, and doing so in a very economical way.
Mm-hmm.
So having good unit economics. Let me give you some numbers. In 4 years, we went from zero to 24 million ARR in all our startups. The first company that we created is over 10 million ARR now, and that company did it with 6 million external funding.
Wow.
And so with
incredible.
Give them 6 million, they go to 10 million year five. And so doing so in a very economical way and finding the right product, the right audience, having good go-to-market sales strategy and everything. And so it's a playbook that is more known because of the tech and because other startups went that path. But that's a very interesting and very important for the ecosystem, because we talk about the SpaceX, the Tesla. I could talk about Michelin. Michelin is a tire maker.
Yeah.
They have 400 data scientists and developers, 400, and they are billing their clients by the hours that they use the tires. And so they are making less tires, but that last longer. And as they are paid by the kilometer, they make a lot more money.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. So it's not just a tire company.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Could you believe? But yeah, for me, they're at the level of Tesla and those type of companies.
Yeah.
And so you have those, but it's less than 5%. Like we have a database. We went to 860 factories in the last 4 years. Like we physically went to 860. Less than 5% of factories are at that level.
Okay.
And so you have to get everyone else on par.
Yeah.
And so service two is very important.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. And for the last, I would say that the head-on competition, what's interesting is that it's a race to become very big before they eat you and kill you. Mm. And so, for example, I angel invested in a company that is doing a new type of meat without meat, with plants and everything, a new startup. And they became the number five brand, not of their category, the number five brand point in 6 years. And they are in that race to get big before they get noticed.
Yeah, right.
And now they have a lot of legal lawsuits and everything because they cannot use the term meat because it's not meat.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Everything. But now they are big enough to fend off that. If they had that just 2 years ago, they would have been killed by the process. And so it's interesting to watch. And definitely interesting. And at the end, it's good for the ecosystem and the consumer, right? The worst case scenario is if those companies, startups don't exist, then you get no innovation, no surplus for the consumer.
Right.
And so it's just bad for everyone.
No, I can't envision you can't envision that kind of future. We're not going back to that anymore. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is what's next for OSS Ventures.
So we are having our first exits with very significant, like more than 10x.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you for that. And so I want to do two things. The first is, I want to create more of those. And the second thing is, I want to switch geography and sometimes, maybe in 18 months, open a US bureau, come back to the motherland and have that kind of US plus European outlook on the world, because Yeah, because it makes sense. And a lot of our companies are already going to the US. So I'm going to do both. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Great. Well, I'm wishing you the best of luck with that. It'll be fun to watch and fun to follow. Yeah. Renan, this has been a fascinating discussion. I mean, I didn't know where it was going to go when we started, but wow, so interesting. Was there something we missed?
Oh, we for sure missed a lot of things, but it was very interesting. Thank you so much for the questions.
Yeah.
And I hope it was of use to the listeners.
I'm sure it was, because every one of our listeners, especially as you went to the role of software in there, so I think you opened a lot of minds. A lot of that was people maybe not thought of these things. If people want to just follow this space or follow kind of what you're doing, what's the best way?
Sure. So they can find us on oss.ventures, that our website, but also on LinkedIn, also on Twitter. So more than welcome. We are actively looking for two types of people. The first is founders who listen to that and say, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I want to work in the space. And so we have a lot more capital and projects than people.
Yeah, good.
That's the first. And the second is actual factory directors thinking, okay, that is very interesting. I want to get in contact with them. And we visit 1 to 2 factories per week with my team. And so we are always more than happy to visit a factory and say, okay, you could get this and this and that up and running. There is a factory in Ohio that is doing that. There is a factory in Japan that is doing that. And so we love being connected, because that's the way that we create and or invest in companies, is because we are always in connection to the field.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking that my advice to every listener, our listeners who's hearing this, send this podcast to the head of manufacturing in your company, because one, I think that person will find it very helpful, informative, valuable just to listen to it. But two, there's that opportunity then to connect, which I think is a great opportunity. So yeah, let's spread the word.
For sure. Thank you for that.
Renan, this has been fun. I thank you again for sharing with us. And, you know, I'm certainly going to keep an eye on where you're going. And I encourage all of our listeners to follow you and see where it goes. Best of luck.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. This was a fun one, because I learned so much. And I love when we have a guest who teaches me a lot of things I didn't know. That's always fun. So I wish you a great week, everybody. Take care and bye for now.
Thanks for joining us this week for Innovation Talks with Paul Heller. If you enjoyed the show, please like and subscribe on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For additional information on today's topic, check out sopheon.com, sopheon.com, where you will find plenty of innovation-centric content and corporate best practices. If you'd like to discuss anything with Paul or would like to get in touch with the show, email us at talks@sopheon.com.